Today on Walk in Faith, I'll be joined by Sister Helen Prejean, an outspoken advocate for abolishing the death penalty. Her journey started when she began to write letters to a prisoner on death row, and it has since evolved into a mission to end the cycle of violence and inspire others to look for a better way. The author of several books, Sister Helen approached Renew International to partner with her in developing a program that encourages small group discussion and personal reflection. The result? Dignity and the death penalty. Evolution of Catholic teaching does just that, challenging people to reflect on the fairness of the criminal justice system and the justice of capital punishment. It offers prayer, Bible passages, and discussion questions, as well as information about the death penalty in the United States, the evolution of Catholic teaching, and insights from Sister Helen. She is here now to talk to us about the journey that brought her to this point and the passion that inspires her every day to fight for the abolishment of capital punishment. Sister Helen, thank you so much for this opportunity. I mean, honestly, I've been looking forward to this interview for a while. Your story has impacted so many lives, and to be able to sit down and just speak with you, honestly, it really is an honor. I got to ask you, growing up in Louisiana, right, your parents instilled this strong foundation of faith. Your mother prayed the rosary with you and your siblings. I know your father, he really gave his life, and he had so much integrity and sacrificed so much for his family to become a lawyer. And I can see how that foundation of faith impacted the rest of your life. Can you tell us a little bit about how did you know that God was calling you to religious life?
Yeah. Well, first of all, Vatican II made it really clear. Everybody's called to holiness. We used to think, oh, the holiest now. I chose the holiest life, to be a nun or to be a priest. There was even this medieval way of predicting, there was a medieval way of showing that priests had a bridge straight to God. The nuns and the religious were all in a boat on the river, but the poor laity was splashing around in the water, doing the best they can not to drown. We kind of had this ladder of holiness. I'm in there with every other Christian or follower of Christ, and I want to position my call that way. The call to be a nun, first of all, I had great nuns teach me in grammar school and high school. And at St. Joseph Academy in Baton Rouge, our nuns taught us to use our minds. It's where I learned to do public speaking, to raise my voice as a woman, to learn to be silent, to go on retreat, to learn the scriptures and to find. So deep faith that did action, and that I became a nun. In my own family, it was a whole religious atmosphere that to be a nun, mom and daddy just really prized that. And so when they took me, when I entered the novitiate on that fateful day in September, and we drove from Baton Rouge with my trunk packed in the back with all my nun clothes, my mama had to sew, to go to New Orleans, I thought I was never going to step foot again in my family house. This was in the 50s, and this was taking literally the call of Jesus in the gospel, that when you leave home and father and mother, you don't go back. Anybody puts their hand to the plow, doesn't look back. I was leaving them forever. But it was like this deep commitment. And when we do get a deep call, you can be crying your eyes out on the back seat, trying to say the rosary with mom and daddy going to the division. But I knew this is what I had to do. Maybe like a little homing pigeon or something. And stepped into the doors of the convent and then embraced my new life. Then I actually dressed in a medieval costume. We had three veils on our heads. All the kids that we taught saw with our faces and our hands. We had 3.5 yards of serge. We had this habit. And I've from the beginning thought my holiness and my call was simply going to be, I was never going to make another decision in my life. I would simply be obedient. To be obedient was to be holy. And the blinder your obedience, the less you question anything you were told to do. That made you even holier. And then when Vatican II hit, it changed everything. Because for the first time, we had a church, a Catholic church. Laity had just been completely passive. If Father said something, you believed it. But Vatican II summoned us to become adult Catholics. to use our minds and to dig into the scriptures. We can read them for the first time ourselves and to discern God's individual call to us.
I mean, you've mentioned so many things. You always talk about discerning, but how does someone know? And I know you did have the foundation of faith, but if someone doesn't have a foundation, how do they know what they're being called? How do they know how to sort of, you know, discern what God is calling them to do for their life?
Well, let's just kind of clarify that, first of all, what does a foundation of faith mean? Well, to have a foundation of faith in a church, to belong to the institutional embodiment of faith. Most people, really, in the world I travel a lot of people do not have that, where they actually belong to that structure that can help your faith. Sometimes it challenges you because the very institution that helps you get to God also can do things that are wrong, and you can recognize it. The foundation of faith is that in every one of us is that divine spark. We call it the indwelling of the Holy Spirit, if you put it in terms of faith. Those that do not have faith, you put it in terms of to want to know truth, to seek truth, and to love deeper, to love in broader boundaries, even to love like Jesus taught us, are all the deep spiritual leaders. The Dalai Lama, the deep spiritual leaders always teach us love. And St. John of the Cross, one of the great mystics in the Catholic Church, said, in the evening of life, we will be judged on love. We have a capacity for love in us that is unending. Foundation of faith is that we are wired in those two things. One of the principles that I go by in discernment of what it is God's calling us to do doesn't necessarily mean that God's calling you to do the hard thing where you're going to necessarily, you're going to have to pay with your life, you're going to have to sacrifice, you're going to have to do this or that. That's not the primary starting point for call. It's attraction. It's what's our desire. What's our deep desire? And when I look back in my life, I could see from sixth grade on, it was to be a teacher. What was better than being in a classroom with young people and helping them learn and become curious and develop their gifts? We first look, what are the principles of attraction and what are the principles of desire? And then we got to make our way like a little homing pigeon to find that. And when we get on the path where we're supposed to be doing what we're doing, it's confirmed in us and the energy flows through us. People ask me, how can you still be working on death penalty after 40 something years? Aren't you getting tired of this? Why don't you burn out? It's because the energy keeps coming back into you when you're doing what God wants you to do.
Sister, it's people like you, honestly, that are on the front line. I mean, you're not just preaching from the pulpit, right? But practicing what they preach. In 1982, you moved to St. Thomas Housing Project in order to live and work with the poor, which I'm assuming you must have been stepping out of your comfort zone. But you've been advocating for the abolishment of capital punishment for, you said, what, almost 40 years now? How does a sister who taught religion and English become a spiritual advisor to an inmate on death row?
Sneaky Jesus. I'm going to tell you two words.
He's sneaky, I know.
I wrote this guy on death row. I didn't know that he was going to be executed. We hadn't had an execution in Louisiana in 1982. We hadn't had an execution in 20 years. It had been an unofficial moratorium all over the United States. I think I'm only going to be writing letters. 2.5 years later, I am in that execution chamber. And if I could just read from the prelude, this is what I experienced and why you're encountering me today and why I'm still on this issue and why I've been dialoguing. And it's in the prelude of the book here. And it goes like this. And this is the fire part of the book. They killed a man with fire one night. They strapped him in a wooden chair and pumped electricity through his body until he was dead. His killing was a legal act because he had killed. No religious leaders protested the killing that night, but I was there. I saw it with my own eyes. And what I saw set my soul on fire, a fire that burns in me still. And now here's an account of how I came to be in the killing chamber that night and the spiritual currents of the gospel that pulled me there. And so when you have an experience that sears your soul and you see it, and this is, I guess, how a prophetic call is born, you go, That's wrong. That's against the dignity of a human being, to strap a person down, render them defenseless, and in a premeditated way, kill them. I don't care who's doing it, government, anybody. And my eyes saw it, my soul caught on fire with it, and I knew when I came out of that execution chamber, what I have to do is, I know people are never going to get close to witnessing that. Mm-hmm. I've been brought in by a sneaky Jesus. I mean, look how he got me, thinking I'm only going to be writing letters. Ended up being in the execution chamber. My life changed forever. And I guess you can call that a call.
So was sneaky Jesus involved in you writing the book and then getting it to Susan Sarandon? I mean, can you tell us about how that one experience became an Academy Award-winning film and an opera?
That's pure God's grace. Pure God's grace, because I had never written a book before. First of all, and all this is providence, I was given a great editor at Random House that helped me shape the book, or you never would have heard of Dead Man Walking. And it was that in the first draft, I had waited too long to talk about the crime, to face the crime of what Pat Sonnier, the first man, of what he and his brother had done. The killing of two teenage kids in cold blood, a .22 rifle pressed against the back of their heads, and killing these two kids outright. But I was so into human rights of the person, why we had to change the death penalty. And here's my editor looking at the first draft, and he says, "You wait far too long to talk about the crime. Nobody's gonna read your book. They're gonna say, well, she's a nun, she believes in forgiveness. She's not gonna be able to face what this guy did, kill these two, and feel the outrage. If you don't put that in the first 10 pages of your book, nobody's going to read your book." And he helped me shape the story to take people through the whole journey, which is first standing there in that outrage and facing that terrible crime, and then making our way together in the book. So here the book comes out, 1993, 80% of the American people in 93 thought the death penalty was a fine idea. What chance does this little book by a nun have? Boom, starts making its way. This is a God thing. You turn it over, and it makes its way into the lap of Susan Sarandon. As soon as it came out in paperback in 94, Arlene Donovan, a friend of hers, gets her that book while she's filming The Client, a Grisham movie in Memphis, Tennessee. She reads the book all night, calls me the next day. I didn't even know who she is. I had to rent this film, Thelma and Louise, see what she looked like. When she came in the restaurant, we were going to meet to talk about doing it. Are you kidding me? A film? I don't know. Thinking she's Gina Davis, she walks in the restaurant. I didn't know anything about movie stars. I still don't. I only know a few. All right? And I said, thank you, Jesus. She's Louise. I mean, it was a relief that she wasn't that ditzy when Gina Davis doing those stupid things. Well, maybe she could be me. And she made that film happen. She pestered Tim Robbins for 9 months till he, probably for domestic tranquility, said, I'll read the blooming nun's book. And kaboom, we had a great film. Oh. Bold film, because he brings you over honestly to both sides. Even the execution, you look at that, where now the audience has some sympathy for Matthew Ponsulate, a combined character of the two people in my book. And he's remorseful and he asks forgiveness and he's executed. And all those on the editing committee with him when he was editing the film said, stop it there, because you got the audience at last. Matthew Ponsulate acknowledged what he did. Don't show the murder again that he did. And Tim Robbins said, I don't want to have the audience. And he juxtaposed Matthew Ponsulate. You see him in the woods. You see him participating in the killing. And he juxtaposed the two killings side by side. And the theater managers told him they had never shown a film where everybody stayed seated till the screen went blank and filed out in silence, because they were thinking, because he brought people over to both sides. Mm-hmm. So kaboom, the film hits. It gets 4 nominations. Susan gets the Academy Award. Craig, get this. On the Feast of the Annunciation in 1996, 1.3 billion people were watching the Academy Awards, and Dead Man Walking was given over to the world. What an all beyond me. You can just see how you do your little bit, mm-hmm. You put it out there, and then God uses it. I was in Japan 6 weeks after the Academy Awards, and the taxi cab driver in Japan's going, Dead Man Walking. It got into the vernacular. Or it's just out there. So you do your little part, you put it out there, you let God take it.
You're right.
And in that film, the very last line across the screen, when you see Dead Man Walking, is Tim Robbins had put, read Sister Helen Prejean's book, Dead Man Walking. And what you hope is that a film leads people to a book. Because mm-hmm. when you read a book and you're quiet and you're experiencing that in the quietness of your own soul, huge changes can happen in you. So we had film, book, film, book, film, book. And the book then went around the world, got translated in 10 languages. Wow. That's God's work. That is God's work.
Amen. I love it. I mean, the film, I watched it again last night. It's fantastic. But now just that last scene, right? That last moment when you're with a victim, right? Before they are being executed. What was interesting in one of your books was about, I forgot his name, but you had ice cream sundaes before. And I was curious about what is the conversation? Like, what's the emotional state where someone knows that in an hour or so they're going to be executed? And is their emotional state different versus, say, someone that's innocent or someone that is guilty?
There's no way you're emotional. Well, either way, it's a human being put to death against their will. So innocent or guilty, you're dealing with that. Even if you're guilty, you're dealing with that. They are coming to kill me. And that's a horrendous situation. You want to experience the ultimate indignity? Is my society so hates me that they feel they have to kill me in order to keep our society safe? It couldn't be worse that you could be more hated than that you have the whole of the institution of society coming against you. Innocence, you can still be scared to death and they're coming to kill me. Actually, Craig, I have experienced now with my seventh man on death row accompanying him. It's the third innocent one. It's so blooming broken. They make mistakes all the time because truth doesn't come out at trial as it's supposed to. But either one, it's a human being in the last moments of their life. I was so shook up. I just kept praying, please, God, please hold him together. Let him have the dignity to walk. And in fact, that was one of the lines I said to Pope John Paul. That when I was walking with Patrick Sonnier to execution and he had these leg irons on, his hands were handcuffed, and he's being walked accompanied by six guards to force him into the electric chair and strap him down. And he kind of turns to me. I'm right behind him. I'm going to read to him from Isaiah 43. I've called you by your name, you are mine, the last moments of his life. And he whispers to me, please pray God holds up my legs when I make this walk. And that's really what I said directly to Pope John Paul II. I said, where is the dignity in this death? He's praying that God will hold up his leg because they're directly going to kill him. Where is the dignity in this death? Can you help our church to see the dignity of all life, not just the innocent? And it was his words to me, asking me to pray for God that led me to say that to the Pope.
I mean, does it give a sense of peace or closure to the victim's family? Someone being executed?
Individuals, more and more victims' families, are speaking out against witnessing the violence the state does, saying that it could possibly heal them. I mean, one example, and this was back in 2011, when the legislature of New Jersey was debating about getting death off the table, repealing the death penalty. And 62 murder victims' families testified before the legislature saying, don't kill for me. The death penalty re-victimizes me. He gets all the notoriety, everything that changes. We'll even know what was his last meal. And here we are waiting all these years for this so-called justice to be done. It may never happen depending on what the court does. And all this time our grief is public. Every time there's a change in the status of his case, the media is at our door. What do you think now? What do you think now? What do you think now? We're just trying to heal. We're trying to get our life together. It doesn't help us, and it puts us in this holding pattern for 20 years, 15 years? And then to be told, okay, now's your moment. You get to sit on the front row and you get to watch as we kill the one who killed your loved one. I mean, think of it as if witnessing that violence can possibly heal a human being. Or as Bud Welch, whose daughter Julie was killed in the Oklahoma City bombing by Timothy McVeigh, as he put it, even if I had watched Timothy McVeigh be killed by closed circuit TV, we could all watch, when after that execution and he'd be dead and I'd come home, the chair that Julie sat in would still be empty. That's my spiritual journey. That's me and God having to work out. I lost my daughter. And actually, as bad as that is, anybody who loses someone they love has to work that out with God, that there's a hole that can never be replaced. And we're in God territory then with these huge losses.
Can't imagine. I mean, does race play a part in being charged for capital murder or being sentenced to the death penalty?
Hands down, it plays a part. You know, you may not immediately see it. You look on death row and say, hey, looks like pretty roughly 50-50, black, white, people of color, white people. Where you look to see where race is who was the victim killed and who cares? Who's outraged by the death of victims and their homicides? Overwhelmingly, it's when white people are killed. We are still a white dominant society. The lives considered most valuable are the lives of our white citizens. And you can see it in the selection for death. When people of color are killed in this country, roughly 50% of all the homicides, but death is seldom sought. The whole expense, the whole years of appeals, ultimate penalty sought. If you don't value the life, you're not outraged over the death. It's pretty simple. It's not hard to see. I mean, we're even seeing that in the systemic racism in the way police treat people. It's different. I mean, George Floyd's death is a big waking up of this country of systemic racism that has been in the police. Not to say all policemen are bad. Of course, they're not all bad. But that's how racism is in institutions. See, it's in systems from long, long years past, from the legacy of slavery. And Black people looked on with suspicion, thrown in for longer prisons. And when you come to the ultimate punishment, of death, you killed this person who was highly valued in society. We going by the criteria, it's supposed to be the worst of the worst. Well, definitely this is the worst of the worst. Whereas here's a young Black kid that's killed in the neighborhood in South Chicago. Not so much.
Just one last question. You mentioned earlier about the letter that you wrote to St. Pope John Paul. Tell me about the meeting when you met with St. Pope John Paul II and Pope Francis and how you urged them to revise the Catholic Church's position on capital punishment.
Well, the one to Pope John Paul was in a letter. It's in my book, Death of Innocence. I was a spiritual advisor to a man, Joseph Odell, in Virginia, who was innocent. He was trying to get his case out and get the truth told before they killed him. And I got involved in his case. Italy got involved with this case, the Italian Parliament, Pope John Paul heard about it, and I got a chance to write him a letter. It went right into his lap. I know that the person who delivered it to the Vatican, to the secretary, to the Pope, he went right on in and he assured me he read your letter. And it was this whole thing of, does the Catholic Church only uphold, a lot of Catholics say they're pro-life, but they mean innocent life. But what about guilty life? I mean, and these people, even those who are guilty of a crime, when they're strapped in and rendered defenseless, Your Holiness, where's the dignity? That's what I said to him and told him those words of Pat Sonier, sister, as I make this walk, please pray, God holds up my legs. It was all about the dignity with Pope John Paul. He laid the foundation, and later, I put it like volleyball game, Pope John Paul, set the volleyball up over the net. Here comes Pope Francis. Because we build the truth and the moral evolution of our conscience as a community and all these moral issues. And then Pope Francis then tipped it over the net. August 2018. Here's why, as Catholics, we will never, ever now uphold the right of the state to take life. You cannot entrust into the hands of vulnerable, frail, ignorant, politically driven, biased human beings this discretionary power to take life or not. And it, so forever now, under no conditions can we have the death penalty. But we're a community of faith, and we build that together, that moral consensus that finally we just reach a point and just say, yeah, we can't do this anymore. Same thing happened with slavery. I mean, white plantation owners would go to church on Sunday and hear from the pulpit, slaves obey your master. In other words, it's part of God's plan. Some people are meant to be slaves. You morally evolve you as a society and as a community of believers.
Wow. What a story. Wow. Sister Helen, you know, just one quick thing. It's like you said, even growing up and even now, I mean, I've been to March for Life several times. We always talk about pro-life, pro-choice, abortion, but we never talk about capital punishment. It's never been a topic of conversation. But I do advise everyone to read Sister Helen, River of Fire, fantastic book. Like I said, off camera and on camera, I loved it. I really did. To watch dead men walking, to join a small group in their parish that's studying dignity and the death penalty, to go on your website. There's so many ways that we can get involved. Like you said, maybe write a letter to someone that's on death row or incarcerated, maybe visit prisons. And Sister Helen, this was honestly an honor, and I value the time and just listening to you speak. So I pray for you to continue to do what you're doing. I pray for everybody on death row, everyone that's incarcerated. God bless you, Sister Helen Prejean.
Thank you, Craig.
Hey guys, I hope you enjoyed today's episode of Walk in Faith with Sister Helen Prejean. Always remember you have the ability to inspire and evangelize through words and actions, and follow her on social media, Twitter, and find out ways how you can get involved and you can be instrumental in eradicating capital punishment. Till next time.